Good evening. If you'll be turning to Ezra chapter 4, please. Ezra chapter 4. We're going to pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago. Last week, Terrell filled in for me. Thank you very much, Terrell, for doing so. But that was a different subject. It was not on Ezra. At least it wasn't. He said it wasn't going to be. So, okay. All right. So we're going to pick up where we left off last week. And this is rather ambitious of me, but I'm going to try to get through 4, 5, and 6 tonight. I know that normally never works out that way, so I'm not too optimistic about that. But we'll see how far we get. But 4, 5, and 6 really do go together as a unit, so we're going to try to get through that this evening. Let's refresh our memories on where we are with everything, the context, and what's going on. Remember, Cyrus had issued the decree that the Jews could go back home, rebuild their temple, restore their nation, and that was in 539 BC. And about 538 is when they started the trip home, and about 536, give or take, was when they would have started the process of rebuilding the temple. And we see all that in chapter 3. They started, though, before they worked on the temple, what did they do first? Not yet. The wall comes later with Nehemiah. Okay, restoring the worship, which starts with what aspect of the worship? The sacrifices. And what do you need in order for the sacrifices? You need animals. Good. Outside of the animals, what else do you need for the sacrifices? You need an altar. And so the very first thing they did was build the altar. And they put it on its base, and they were able to begin the daily sacrifices and all the things that are associated with that. And then a few months later is when they laid the foundation for the temple. That's there in chapter 3. So, this brings us to chapter 4 now. And so let's take a look at some verses. We've already looked at these verses a little bit, but we'll look at it in more detail tonight. Let's read verses 1 through 3 to begin with. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Now, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we have sacrificed to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said to them, "You may do nothing with us to build a house for our God, but we alone will build to the Lord God of Israel as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." Okay, so we've talked about this, but let's say it again. Who are these people that are there in the land that they're referring to? Where did they come from? Okay. Other lands that Assyria had conquered and other peoples, and then brought them from wherever they were to the land of Israel and deposited them there because the Israelites were taken away captive by the Assyrians. But were all the Israelites taken away? No. Most of them were, but some of them were left behind. And what category of people would have been the ones left behind? The ones that weren't a threat, the weak, the old, those that were really of no use to the kingdom of Assyria, those that would not cause a problem, and those that couldn't be used elsewhere in the kingdom. Okay, now by New Testament times, what has happened to the people that were brought in and the Israelites that were there? Okay, they began to mingle and intermarry, and what are those descendants referred to in the New Testament? Samaritans, okay, named after Samaria, the area of Samaria there. So that's who we're talking about here is these people are the ones that were brought in to the area from other places in the kingdom. And it mentions Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, was the one that brought them there. Now, actually, they could have gone back to a previous king as well. Esarhaddon was the third king. This would have been the third generation king after Sargon, who was the one that actually defeated the Sumerian 721 BC. Esarhaddon is several years after that. And in fact, another Assyrian king is mentioned later in the chapter as being the ones that brought them there. It obviously was something that was going on throughout several years, where you've got conquerings and deportations and exiles and, you know, mixing up the peoples throughout that time. Now, Zerubbabel's response seems rather rough and not too kind. And we talked about this. Why is it that he's so against them helping? I mean, this is an offer to help and build. And they say, hey, we've been worshiping Yahweh since we were brought here. So what's the big deal?
God has separated the people out. He had separate people, and this was a mixed race, so they were
okay. That's certainly part of it, is that these people were not a pure race. They were pagans originally. But now it says that they're worshiping Yahweh. They have been ever since they were brought to that land. Let me ask you this question. What kind of Yahweh worship was taking place in Israel, the northern nation, when the Assyrian captivity happened?
Was it correct they wouldn't have it their own priest?
Yeah. Was not the correct pure form of Yahweh worship, was it? They had Jeroboam had established priesthood from all tribes. You have the calves, the golden calves at Dan and Bethel. And so you take somebody from some other section of the Assyrian Empire, bring them in there, and they're introduced to Yahweh worship. Well, it's not really true, pure Yahweh worship, is it? So what they know of Yahweh and of the Yahweh worship, is it the same as what Zerubbabel knows and wants to do with Yahweh worship? No, it's a paganized, adulterated form of Yahweh worship. And so they're not pure Jews. They don't really have the proper knowledge of Yahweh worship. And if you're a pagan, what's your view of Yahweh anyway? Okay, yeah, they're worshiping him, but what's really their understanding? Yeah, he's just one of several gods. He just happens to be the god of this territory. And so why would they worship the god of that territory? I mean, they're living there. Why would they worship him instead of the gods that they grew up with, for instance? Yeah, he's got control of that territory, and they want prosperity. They want the blessings of that god. They don't want to get on his bad side. So their understanding and their attitude and purpose is not at all what God is warning, and Zerubbabel understands that. But there's something else too, Steve. Okay. I don't know if he would necessarily take offense or not, but that edict was specifically for Zerubbabel and the Jews. It wasn't for anybody else to do it. So they have the authority and the right to be doing this. It's for them to do. It's their nation. While they may be living there and have been living there for generations, by the time Zerubbabel comes, it's not for them. It's for the Jews. So I don't know if he would necessarily fence or not, but that edict really wasn't for them. There's something else there that's hinted at right away when Ezra, who I'm assuming is the one that's writing this, identifies these people. What does he call them? Adversaries. Now, there's nothing at the first in their request and the way they approach Zerubbabel that would clue you in on the fact that they're adversaries. But what happens when Zerubbabel says no? What's their attitude at that point? Yeah. They hire counselors and they frustrate their purposes and they oppose any efforts of rebuilding the temple at that point. In other words, they show their true colors, don't they? And so Ezra, of course, writing after the fact, I mean, he knows that they're adversaries, and he's pointing that out to us right from the very beginning, that these really aren't goodwill people here. They're not really after the goodwill of the nation or of the Jews. In fact, while he doesn't say this outright, what do you think might be the reason why they wanted to join in? And when they were rebuffed, they turned on them. What do you think might be a motive? Okay, maybe they didn't even want it to be built anyway, and so they were going to hinder it in some way. Okay. I think there's another possibility, and this is speculation, of course, here, but they've been in the land for a lot longer than these people that are just coming back. What happens when these people come back and they build and they rebuild their little territory and their nation and so forth? They're going to either potentially lose their land or at the very least lose any control or influence, right? And so it seems to me that at least a likely scenario is that this is a feigned attempt to try to keep control or gain control, be in positions of influence and power and so forth. If they're involved in this, then they have a say-so. And Zerubbabel says, no, you don't have a say-so. You don't have any part of this. And when they are rebuffed, then their true colors do come out, and they are their opponents at that point and are not really after the goodwill of the people there. So, there may have been that motive as well. Not really sure, but I think it's safe to say that the motive was not really a good motive. It wasn't because they really wanted the temple to be rebuilt or the nation to be rebuilt or anything of that nature. That's obvious from their reaction. Because if they were true to Yahweh, if they really were concerned about and the well-being of the nation and worshiping Yahweh the proper way, then they wouldn't have turned on them like they did afterwards. Okay, so let's keep going and take a look at the next few verses here. Starting with verse 5, it says, starting with verse 4, then the people of the land tried to discourage the people of Judah. They troubled them in building and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. If you're part of the Facebook group, I posted on there for you to read in advance of tonight, Ezra 4 through 6. And I mentioned that chapter 4 has the potential of being confusing there, and something about the way it's written that could potentially be confusing. And when you read through this chapter, for those of you who have read ahead, what is it that, and maybe you are confused, maybe you didn't figure it out, but what is it that's potentially confusing about the way it's written? Maybe it wasn't confusing to anybody. Nobody's confused? Good. Say that again. Okay. Yeah. We start out with Cyrus, and then here in chapter 4, we end up all the way to the king that was king when Nehemiah came on the scene. Okay. And what can be potentially confusing about this is if you don't understand the history and the timeline and who the Persian kings are, And I know that for some of you, as soon as I say history, your eyes roll back in the back of your head, and you're like, oh, brother, here he goes again with his timelines and dates and historical context and so forth. But if you don't know this, then chapter 4 can be confusing. What you have in chapter 4, from verse 5 all the way down to verse 23, pay attention to the verses here, to through verse 23, you have a general overview of all the oppositions they received in this restoration process, not just in the days of Cyrus, but going all the way up through the days of Artaxerxes. And so that covers a lot of years. And then in verse 24, without really giving you a good clue as to what he's doing, he comes back to the days of Cyrus, or actually Darius, which is the next king after Cyrus. So from verse 5 through 23 is an overview that covers a lot of years. And then verse 24 comes back to this very first opposition that halted the temple rebuilding process. So let's just quickly take a look at these Persian kings that are listed here. And there's a couple of Persian kings that are not listed. And then we'll read through what he says in this overview. Okay, first of all, you got Cyrus the Great. He's the one that let the Jews go back home with that decree that came about in 539 B.C. He reigned from 560 to 530, but in 539 B.C. is when he issued that decree that's recorded for us at the beginning of this book and the end of 2 Chronicles as well. And so after him, you have Cambyses, who was his son, who ruled from 530 to 522 B.C. There's a little bit of an anarchy period after Cambyses, there's some debate. I'm not going to get into all the details, but there's some debate about who it was that ruled after Cambyses was assassinated. Either it was Bardiah, who was another son of Cyrus, or somebody that was impersonating him by the name of Galmada. There's a big debate about that. It doesn't really matter. They're not mentioned. Cambyses and Bardiah is not mentioned in Ezra 4. But Darius the Great is. That's the one that said that they frustrated their efforts from Cyrus all the way to Darius. So that whole period there, they're receiving this opposition, and no work is being done on the temple. And it said until the second year of Darius's reign, which would make it at 520 B.C., is when, and we're going to get to this in just a moment, when Haggai and Zechariah come on the scene and stir them up and they start rebuilding again. So you have from about 536 B.C. to 520 B.C., 16 years that the temple construction process is lying dormant. Nothing is being done to it. And that's in the second year of Darius the Great. After Darius the Great, you have Ahasuerus. He's the one who is also known as Xerxes. Most time in the Bible, he's going to be referred to as Ahasuerus. And then after him is Artaxerxes. By the way, who is this right here? Or who is his wife? One of his wives? Come on, Colby. Esther. Yeah, that's Esther's husband right there. And so you have, in Ezra 4, you've got Cyrus the Great mentioned, you've got Darius mentioned, you've got Ahasuerus, and you've got Artaxerxes that are mentioned as, in these time frames, these time periods, underneath these kings, there was several oppositions that took place. So let's take a look at this, and remember that verse 5 through 23 is just the overview of all these oppositions. Ezra, of course, is writing during the reign of Artaxerxes, and he's writing this. So, verse 5, they hired the counselors until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Verse 6, in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. In the days of Artaxerxes also, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabel, and the rest of their companions wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And the letter was written in Aramaic script, and translated into the Aramaic language. Rehum, the commander, in Shimshai, the scribe, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to King Artaxerxes in this fashion. From Rehum, the commander, Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their companions, representatives of the Danaites, the I have no idea how to say that one. The Tarpalites, the people of Persia, and Erech and Babylon, and Shushan, the Dehavites, the Elamites, and the rest of the nations, whom the great and noble Osnapper took captive and settled in the cities of Samaria, and the remainder beyond the river, and so forth. This is a copy of the letter that they sent to him. To King Artaxerxes from your servants, the men of the region beyond the river, and so forth. Okay, that's twice now that's mentioned the region beyond the river. What river? What's the main river in that Levant region? Remember, they're in they're writing to Persia. They're in Israel area, Samaria. What river is in between the two? The Euphrates. Okay, that's the big river. And that's the river that flows through Babylon. Okay, so they're in the region beyond the river from the Persian standpoint. Verse 12. Let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you have come to us at Jerusalem and are building the rebellious and evil city and are finishing its walls and repairing the foundations. Okay, now, remember, this is the letter that's taking place or that's written during the time of Artaxerxes. So we're fast-forwarding here in this overview to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay. They're finishing its walls and repairing the foundations. Let it now be known to the king that if this city is built and the walls completed, they will not pay tax, tribute, or custom, and the king's treasury will be diminished. Now, because we received support from the palace, it was not proper for us to see the king's dishonor. Therefore, we have sent and informed the king that search may be made in the book of the records of your fathers, and you will find in the book of the records and know that this city is a rebellious city, harmful to kings and provinces, and that they have incited sedition within the city in former times, for which cause this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls are completed, the result will be that you will have no dominion beyond the river. Okay, so you have these people opposing the Jewish efforts in the time of Artaxerxes now, and they're appealing to what aspect? Okay, they want to stop it, but what are they appealing to? Money. That's right. You let this go on, you're not going to get taxes anymore, you're not going to get tribute anymore. You might want to put a stop to this. And we're after your good. We don't want to see dishonor to you, the king, Artaxerxes. So verse 17, the king sent an answer to Rehum, the commander, and all those people beyond the river and so forth. Verse 18, the letter which you sent to us has been clearly read before me. And I gave the command, and a search has been made, and it was found that this city in former times has revolted against kings, and rebellion and sedition have been fostered in it. There have also been mighty kings over Jerusalem who have ruled over all the region beyond the river, and tax, tribute, and custom were paid to them. Now give the command to make these men cease, that this city may not be built until the command is given by me. Take heed now that you do not fail to do this. Why should damage increase to the hurt of the kings? Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum, Shimshai the scribe, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem against the Jews, and by force of arms made them cease. Thus the work of the house of God which was at Jerusalem ceased, and it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now remember, verse 24 that I just read brings us all the way back to Cyrus's and Darius's time frame. But that big long letter was after that in the time of Artaxerxes. By the way, I'm just going to give a little preview here, and we'll talk about it more when we get there. But I said Artaxerxes was in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. What did Nehemiah do? What was his mission when he came back? To rebuild the wall. So does this seem kind of odd? The king that gave Nehemiah permission to go back and rebuild the wall is the king that is mentioned here that says, no, you put a stop to that wall rebuilding stuff. How do we reconcile that? Say that first part again.
Did you not find writings where they had been told to do it?
That comes, that's Darius in the next chapter. Okay, Nehemiah was obviously really close to the king. He was the cupbearer. He had the king's ear. He was a very, very close advisor, actually, to the king. Likely, and this is one possible scenario, we'll talk about it more when we get to Nehemiah, but what is possibly happening is that this attempt to rebuild the wall that is stopped by Artaxerxes happens before Nehemiah's time. But during the reign of Artaxerxes, but before Nehemiah comes to him and says, hey, I want to go back and rebuild. It says that you do not, you need to make them cease until the command goes out by me that they can rebuild. So maybe what happens is later on that command by him does go out through Nehemiah to rebuild, but just... Well, Nehemiah doesn't approach Artaxerxes until well into his reign. And so this could have come early in Artaxerxes' reign and before Nehemiah approached him. So there's plenty of time there in Artaxerxes' reign for this to have happened beforehand. Got a question? Okay. All right. So, again, 5 through 23, overview of all the opposition that the Jews faced in rebuilding both the temple and the walls. And then verse 24 brings us back. Now Ezra's going to focus in on the time of Darius. Okay, so does everybody understand that? Everybody see the structure here of chapter 4? Okay. So let's go to chapter 5 then. Yes, sir. Yeah, I know. Yeah, after he's just got through talking about Artaxerxes. And Artaxerxes comes well after Darius. Yeah. Yeah, that's the confusing thing that I was hinting at, is that if you just read through this, and if you're not really familiar with the timeline of the Persian kings, or even if you are familiar with it, and you know that Artaxerxes comes after Darius, then, huh? What? What's he talking about here? But you got to look at it as, okay, overview. Now I'm going to come back and focus in on a specific time frame of Darius. Steve? It's okay. Hey, I sound stupid all the time. So.
Maybe they're hearing all these people's reign. Did they really keep time that way? I mean, you're going back to the future, but you're going back.
No, this is our reckoning. They would have kept time by, you know, what king it is and how many years into his reign and so forth. Because remember, B.C., of course, means before Christ. Yeah. Paul?
Maybe that was the reason Nehemiah counted was so well. When the king questioned him, why he looked so unhappy.
Right. Yeah, he had heard from his brethren that came from Jerusalem that the walls were still in a state of disrepair. And, that could have been the report, is that we were trying, but the king didn't let us, and they've hindered us again. So, yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay, so moving on to chapter 5, what we have is that 16 years have passed from the time that Zerubbabel laid, and all the people working with him in chapter 3, laid the foundation to the temple. 16 years go by. Nothing is done because of all this opposition. And we're now in the second year of the reign of Darius. Before we actually go to chapter 5, go with me to Haggai, please. Chapter 5, verse 1 talks about Haggai and Zechariah being sent by God. So let's go take a look there for just a moment. And in Haggai chapter 1, it says, in the second year of King Darius, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jehozadak the high priest, saying, thus speaks the Lord of hosts, saying, this people says, the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. So the people are saying, It's not time yet. Oh, well, it's been 16 years. And yet they're saying it's not time yet. Then the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses and the temple to lie in ruins? In other words, you've taken care of your own self, your own houses, and you've got these paneled houses you're living in, and yet my temple is nothing. It's in ruins. Now therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat but do not have enough. You drink but you are not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. Why do you think that that has happened? Why is it that, what's the implication that God's trying to get across to them that, hey, you've been sowing the field but you're not getting much and you don't have much in the way of water, you don't have much in the way of wages. Why is that? God hasn't blessed them. Yeah, this was a temporal judgment of God. He's trying to get them to see, look, you're not putting your priorities right. And when that didn't work, he sent Haggai and Zechariah. So verse 7, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountains and bring wood and build the temple that I may take pleasure in and be glorified. You look for much, but indeed it came to little, and when you brought it home, I blew it away. Why? Because of my house that is in ruins, while every one of you runs to his own house. Verse 11, I called a drought on the land and on the mountains, and on the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and on the labor of your hands. I've done all this to try to wake you up. You haven't been listening. Listen to Haggai. So verse 12 of Haggai 1, then Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and Joshua the son of Jehozadak the high priest with all the remnant of the people obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet as the Lord their God had sent them, and the people feared the presence of the Lord. And so he stirs them up and they resume work on the temple in 520 BC, the second year of Darius the Great. It takes them about 4 or 5 years to finish it. It's finished in 515 B.C. And we're going to see that when we go back to Ezra. But so after 16 years, Haggai says, get busy. And they do. They had great zeal to begin with, but they let the opposition get them down, and they didn't do anything except take care of their own selves for 16 years. So go back to Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1. There, Haggai and Zechariah are sent. Verse 2, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. But opposition comes again. In verse 3, at the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar Boznai and their companions came to them and spoke thus to them, who has commanded you to build this temple and finish this wall? Then accordingly, we told them the names of the men who were constructing this building. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so that they could not make them cease till a report could go to Darius. Then a written answer was returned concerning this matter. This is a copy of the letter that Tattenai sent, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar Boznai and his companions, the Persians, who were in the region beyond the river to Darius the king. And then in verse 8, all the way through verse 17, you have this letter that they send. And basically what they say in this letter is, here is what they have told us. Here's what the Jews have told us. That Cyrus sent out a decree long ago and saying, go back home, rebuild your temple. And all the articles of the temple you can put back, you take with you, and we're going to help you help pay for it. They sent money and support and so forth. This is what they're claiming. And by the way, what is their claim as far as the reason why the temple was destroyed in the first place? Say again. Yeah, because of their sins. And so the Jews say, look, the reason why it was destroyed is because we were unfaithful to our God. You remember the other letter back during in Artaxerxes later on? They said it's because they're just a rebellious city, and You know, and that's the reason why I was destroyed. Well, yeah, but they're ultimately rebellious to God. So verse 12, it describes that. But because our fathers provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, and so forth. So they send this letter to Darius and say, you need to search and find out whether or not this is true. Because otherwise, kind of the same implication, they're going to rise up and rebel, and you know, they don't have authority to be doing this. I love Darius' response. Take a look at chapter 6. Then King Darius issued a decree, and a search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon, and at Achmetha, in the palace that is in the province of Media, a scroll was found, and in it a record was written thus. And it describes the decree of Cyrus and the instructions for them to go back and rebuild the temple. It even describes the size of the temple, 60 cubits by 60 cubits, and for the foundation, and three rows of heavy stones, one row of new timber, verse 4, and let the expenses be paid from the king's treasury, and all the gold and silver articles that Nebuchadnezzar had taken are to be returned, and so forth. And he even goes a little bit further. Remember, Tattenai and all these people are trying to get them to stop. But verse 6, now therefore, Tattenai, governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai, and so forth, verse 7, let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God on its site. Moreover, I issue a decree as to what you shall do for the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God. Let the cost be paid at the king's expense from taxes on the region beyond the river. This is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered. And whatever they need, young bulls, rams, and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, according to the request of the priests who are in Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. Also, I issue a decree that whoever alters this edict, let a timber be pulled from his house and erected, and let him be impaled on it, and let his house be made a refuse heap because of this. You talk about backfiring. It's exactly what happens to Tattenai. They're trying to stop it, and it backfires on them. Because now, not only are they to leave it alone, but what else? They got to give them the supplies. They got to foot the bill. If they had just left them alone, they wouldn't have had to do any of that, probably. They could have gotten away with it. But no, Darius says, yeah, I found the decree from Cyrus. So you're going to help them. You're going to give them the money for the taxes. You're going to give them the animals for the sacrifices. You're going to supply all that. And you're going to help them any way you can, any way they need help. And if they refuse to do so, what's the consequence?
Their own house fall in.
Yeah. Now, the New King James, which I'm reading out of, actually says in verse 11, let him be hanged on that timber. That's actually a bad translation. The Assyrians and Persians, it is a well-known fact, they didn't do hanging, they did impaling. It really, the word that's there has to do with impaling. And when we get to Esther, the gallows, another bad translation that Haman built, that was impaling. That's what they did. And some of your translations may have impaling, or at least have a footnote. And his house be made a refuse heap, or a dung hill, some of your translations may say. So, talk about irony, and a humorous irony, in my opinion, that here they're trying to stop it, and the tables are turned on them, and now they're going to help. In verse 12, not only that, he says, may the God who causes his name to dwell there destroy any king or people who put their hand to alter it or to destroy this house of God which is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, issue a decree, let it be done diligently. And so verse 13, guess what Tattenai does and his companions? They diligently help. Because they don't want to be impaled, and they don't want their house made a refuse heap, and they don't want all those consequences. They're okay. They'll do it. And then in verse 15, the temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar. Now I know all of you know Exactly what that corresponds to in our calendar, right? You're familiar with the Jewish calendar, all the various months, and right? Everybody know? Yeah, sure. Adar is the last month of their calendar. It corresponds to February, March. So right now is the month of Adar, as a matter of fact, in the Jewish calendar. And that was in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. How much time do I have? Till 10 till? Is that right? Got about 4 minutes? Okay. Any questions or comments on that section? Anything that anybody doesn't understand? Okay, I want to quickly introduce something and we'll develop this further next week. In verse 16 through 18, the temple is completed and you have the temple dedication ceremony. Verse 17, they offered sacrifices at the dedication of this house of God, 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats according to the number of the tribes of Israel. They assigned the priests to their divisions and the Levites to their divisions over the service of God in Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses. And then in verse 19, through the end of the chapter, you have them keeping the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Here's what I want you to do. Here's your homework assignment for next week. Go ahead and you might want to read this again, verse 16 through the end of the chapter. I want you to compare this temple dedication ceremony. This is Zerubbabel's temple, by the way, little side bit here. If you ever hear people refer to the first temple period and the second temple period, they're referring to Solomon's temple and Zerubbabel's temple. Okay, that's the two temple periods. Now, when you come to the New Testament time frame and you got Herod, and sometimes it's referred to as Herod's temple, it's not that Herod rebuilt the temple, he just expanded it. But it's still the second temple period. And Zerubbabel is the one that rebuilt the second temple. But I want you to pay attention to the description of this temple dedication ceremony. And then go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 5, 6, and 7. 2 Chronicles 5, 6, and 7. That's the dedication of the first temple of Solomon. Read through that and note the differences between those two dedication ceremonies. 2 Chronicles 5, 6, and 7. We'll talk about that. There's a significant difference or differences that I want to point out next week and develop a little bit further. Also, in 2 Chronicles 30, there is a Passover celebration there underneath King Hezekiah during his restoration period and efforts. There's some differences between that and this Passover celebration. So we'll be talking about that next Wednesday. Any final questions or comments? All right. Thank you, guys.